Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is the Berlinale series continuing. I definitely didn't just record another episode. These are separated by days upon days. This is sort of in the last few days of the festival, really, although there still are premieres of competition titles and encounters titles. And to talk about, we're going to be doing a mix of like sort of brand new titles and also some from earlier in the festival. And to talk about that medley of films is Jessica Kiang, who is filing with
Variety. And a couple for Sight and Sound, and I will be doing a New York Times wrap as well.
Oh, cool. That's good. A lot to look forward to. So, thoughts? No.
Yes, we are at that stage of the festival where it's just, where you can just basically stare at a person across the way and just try and talk about how tired you are.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one question that I usually don't find too fruitful, but I am kind of curious what your perception would be if, like, is this a strong edition or what does that mean? And maybe that it's kind of neither here nor there. And that's actually a good thing because they could just focus on putting on good movies. You know?
I mean, I think that's true. But I do feel that I think especially since the pandemic and especially when we start comparing each edition to previous, you know, recent editions, which have either been hybrids or had to go online, or last year when we had all of these restrictions and we had to get tested every day and all of those things.
Yes.
So I think it actually is kind of instructive and it is sort of important this time to be talking about, you know, how it has panned out. And I think really on the ground, I'm really pleasantly surprised and impressed by the selection this year. Mm-hmm. I think last year was weak overall in the history of Berlinales, which was odd as well because last year was a physical edition, although there was no EFM on, there was no film market on. And so it felt kind of dead to be here, but we were actually here and in cinemas. And yet the films were not themselves as good as the previous year, which had been wholly online. So mm-hmm. there has been this sort of up and down, you know, when you map the quality of the films against the quality of the actual experience of attending the festival. So I really feel like this year has been the first one in a while where Berlinale is kind of back, baby. and it, the on-the-ground experience is back and it's fun. Mm. And it actually feels slightly starrier than Berlin would normally be. There was this big Steven Spielberg presentation last night, which is apparently a big deal. I mean, I never get to see any of these things,
right.
But I hear about them. And obviously the sort of the star wattage of the jury this year as well, with Kristen mm-hmm. Stewart in charge of it, and it's one of the things that Berlin doesn't necessarily ordinarily do, like mm-hmm. have a lot mm-hmm. of red carpets and have a lot of sort of glitz. And this year it feels to me like they made a special effort to do that. Mm-hmm. And I would be suspicious of that if it weren't for the fact that the films, I think actually the quality of the films kind of back it up, especially those in the competition that I've seen.
Yeah, I agree with that for sure. I mean, we can start with one of the movies that is like very anticipated, and I guess we've seen today. Is today today?
Today. We saw it this morning.
And that is the new Christian Petzold film. And I guess this is basically where he premieres his films. I'm trying to remember if he has done otherwise for a while. And this one is, we were just talking about, is called A Fire. One word in English, although in German it might be a bit better.
Yeah, in German it's Roter Himmel, which just means red sky, which is germane to one of the ongoing themes of the film. And it's also just a nicer title than A Fire, which, as we're saying, has a sort of, not only is it going to be difficult to be like, so are you going to a fire? does it sound a bit wrong? It's also just slightly pretentious. And the film itself is absolutely not. The film is very refreshingly not in those registers. The film is actually very funny, which is kind of an unusual register for Petzold to be working in, but it walks this really interesting tonal balance, I think, and I really enjoyed it. It's my favorite of his recent films.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I had a bit of a mixed response to it. I mean, I found it sort of more conceptual, although in a way, like, but I mean, oh, yeah, just to back up, it's about two friends who are going on a kind of work getaway, I guess, basically. Mm-hmm. They're going to, you know, one friend, his family has a house in the woods. So one of them is a writer, Leon, and his friend Felix is the one whose family is the house is. And he's a photographer.
He's a photographer. He's applying to art school. So he's putting together a portfolio.
So he's allegedly working, but he just conspicuously is much looser and more laid back.
Yeah.
So at first, that's kind of the dynamic that, you might think it's just going to be a comedy of odd couple almost. Mm-hmm. And they have all sorts of obstacles just even getting there. But eventually, this being a Petzold film, Paola Bear does materialize. She is already in the house.
It's basically actually the setup of Barbarian.
Oh, wow. That's true.
I mean, yes. So they don't really expect her to be there.
That's right.
But yes, she's apparently the niece of one of Felix's mother's friends. And Felix's mother has not told him that she's going to be there. So there's this slightly awkward moment and an awkward few days when they suddenly realize they're going to have to share the place with this woman.
I mean, it kind of takes a while for you to realize that that's most of the movie, more or less. And it's just watching Leon kind of being grumpy about, you know, not being able to get his writing done, whether for reasons of, you know, loud lovemaking in the next room or bug bites in the outdoors or anything to blame except the fact that maybe he's not a good writer or something, which is sort of hinted at. And, you know, eventually even his publisher comes out. So that's why I thought the movie was kind of conceptual. And now I kind of hesitate because in order to explain why it's conceptual, I kind of have to describe things that you spend a long time waiting for in the film. Mm. But, I mean, going into the movie, and he's talked about this movie for at least I remember interviewing him for his last film that when it was released, where he described the concept, and it was...
Oh, really?
That, yeah, okay. That kind of... My next movie will be about how life is affected by forest fires. And I was like, what does that mean? So it's kind of funny to have that general idea. The sort of thing where you interview a director and like they tell you the next movie and you sort of feel if they're kind of trying it out on you a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's no way you can know where it's going. And that's also what I love. But
yeah, I had that with James Gray when he told me
really?
The entire plot of what was going to become Ad Astra. And then I saw Ad Astra and it was like nothing like the film.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's his name? Ruben Ostlund was blatantly doing that in Cannes because he told every single interview the same airplane movie plot,
but
with little details changed. that's kind of the looming in the background because they're going to this seaside resort, which is right next to a huge forest, which is vulnerable to these fires. So you know something's going to happen. And yeah, I guess no spoiler to say that something does. And what does happen is kind of tragic. I mean, the movie that came to mind a little bit is, do you remember that Oliveira movie where there's terrorism, that like a boat explodes or something? It's from the early 2000s.
Oh, I don't think I've seen it.
It was kind of an incredible thing to watch, like in whatever it was, 03 or 04, you know? Because it's a whole movie that appears to be like this kind of ambling thing on like a cruise, but it all builds up to this point of an actual terrorist act. Mm-hmm. And it's, for some reason, that kind of shattering of like a pretty ordinary texture, which is what this movie does, that came to mind. Although in this case it's a natural disaster that happens, but I don't know, what was your experience of the film?
I think one of the things I found so interesting about it is kind of speaks to what you're saying. I think I always find there's something very specifically Petzold in a certain approach that basically even in very ordinary exchanges you always get the sense that there's almost something kind of surreal or something, there's some sort of time slippage going on, or there's some sort of, there's going to be some big conceptual reveal. There's going to be, she's a ghost, or, you know,
they're all dead.
Exactly. Or he's his twin. You know, so you get the feeling that he's sort of hinting that there's something almost mystical or something else going on. And I think that has been the case in a lot of his films, that there's always something, especially in the relationships between people, that suggests that either this is, you know, not the first time that they have met, or that there's some kind of odd textures that go on. And this film has that sense as well. And I think actually then weirdly really benefits, for me anyway, really benefited by not having the big reveal, by not having that. Mm-hmm. So it sort of toys with this slight strangeness. There's always a slight strangeness. And I think I could even put that down to it being the strangeness of there being a forest fire raging nearby. Mm. It's just, it's a thing that like literally changes the atmosphere.
Right.
But meantime, what we're actually watching is the very, to me, very Eric Romerian interplay between these four characters, and then five when the publisher comes. Because we should say there's a fourth character who is David, who is the lifeguard. David with an E. Yes, it's very specific. So he's the lifeguard on the local on the beach nearby. He starts the film as the Paula Bearer character's lover, and ends it as somebody else's lover. And there's lots of these sort of dinner party scenes and you know, casual al fresco dinners outside between the four of them, with Felix Leon, Paula Bearer, and David. And the four of them, most of the awkwardness flows directly from Leon's character himself, who is also, I think he's so well cast as well. He's like this sort of, you know, slightly pudgy. He's obviously, he just carries a lot of writerly angst in him, I think. There was quite a lot of sort of knowing laughter in the audience, which is obviously at a press screening almost primarily composed of writers, during those moments when he's really revealing himself to be an incredibly petty and very insecure, slightly narcissistic guy who is, he's trying to write his second novel. We hear an extended excerpt from that second novel, and it's awful. I mean, it's truly awful, and it's an excruciating scene. But it's also his reactions to criticism, his fear of being criticized. All of these things are actually inherently relatable, even though he is himself, I mean, he's just an awful character. I mean, he's an awful person. So the kind of the tentative sort of attraction or love affair that is kind of happening between him and the Paula Bearer character is sort of, it's almost like it's something that he doesn't really deserve. And there's a nice through line, I think, of him, you know, he's a writer, so he's one of life's observers, of course, and he never really participates. Right. He never swims in the sea. He sort of jealously looks at the bodies of other men going by and, you know, is always covered up and, you know, covering himself in bug spray or whatever it is. And so there's that sort of neurosis that he has going on. And it's this sort of idea that just because you are the observer of things doesn't mean you're actually very observant. And he you know, he fails to notice massively obvious things that are happening right in front of his face. So it's I mean, I suppose eventually there's an iota of growth there, but it's not really a kind of film that is dealing in some sort of massive arc of change for him. And a lot of it is just these sort of incidents that happen in between these characters, and they're done with this lightness again, but again, that has this slight, just very slightly, very Petzoldian undercurrent of something maybe sinister or something maybe supernatural almost going on as well. And for me, all of those textures really worked together in this. They're very surprising. And also, it uses a great song. We finally have a soundtrack song, which is the song at the very beginning of A Fire, which I think was just great. And I've been playing it nonstop on my Spotify since.
No, it's definitely like a good like headphone
chill
out sort of song. He's a funny character, the Leon character, also, because I felt almost he was like, I mean, he's this stick in the mud, basically, and he's almost representative of like old-fashioned expectation that he's going to be the center either of attention, whether or not he deserves it, or also like everything would be happening to him.
It's not.
So I thought that was also part of the kind of what the movie was doing. And yeah, I mean, for some reason, somehow the texture wasn't dense enough, I guess. In addition to like the shadow world behind the real world feel you have with these Petzl things, there's also like the storybook thing that he's gotten interested in as well, that became very explicit with Undine, the last Berlin title, the self-awareness of these storybook patterns that we're in with maybe an explicit like fairy tale, you know, and the fact that this is in a forest, but it's not a forest with like witches and goblins or something. It's a forest with a very real, like, you know, climate threat. So that was kind of interesting, but by that point I was just like, yeah, I hadn't gotten enough somehow, so I felt I was sort of undernourished. I wish it were otherwise.
I think it's also, I mean, for me, one of the reasons that I have preferred it to his, I consider this now like almost a trilogy, because it's his Paula Bearer films. And I'm historically not a particular fan of Paula Bearer, and it's especially in the early Petzold films where she sort of came in to replace Nina Hoss. And I did actually just basically directly hold it against her that she wasn't Nina Hoss. I would be watching scenes in Transit or in Undine and just being like, why aren't you Nina Hoss? This would be so much better. better if you were Nina Haas, which is very unkind of me, but I'm a very unkind person. And this one, I think it's also because she's not playing against somebody as strong as Franz Rogowski.
Right.
That character, therefore, so there seems to be more of a balance between those characters. I can see what you mean, that there isn't the same sort of punchiness. There isn't that same actual conceptual twist that sort of brings it all together and makes sense of these various different textures that he has going on at the same time. But to me, that actually works to the strength of the film, because it is at least evenly uneven in a way, as opposed to, for me, both Undine and Transit sort of suffered because there was a big imbalance between the two main characters, and I didn't feel like I really believed those relationships at any point. So
yeah.
These ones I totally believe, even though, even still here, I mean, there are slightly just odd flourishes to her character. She never wears anything but that red dress. Did you notice that? Like, she's always, and so then I was starting to think, well, you know, is she a character that he's writing partly in his mind? Because I'm starting to anticipate this big conceptual reveal, right? Like, they're all in his mind.
Yeah.
And like things like that just aren't explained.
Yeah.
But then there's other moments where certain reveals do happen, and they are actually mostly played for laughs. It's when we discover what her actual job is, or what she I mean, that's just a really hilarious scene.
Yeah.
It's beautifully played by all those actors. So the indefinably uneven texture worked really well for me here.
Yeah. I think often with his movies, actually, a second watch is really interesting. So I do look forward to that with A Fire.
Or Temel.
Well, let's talk about reality.
Okay, reality.
which I was kind of surprised to find. I don't know. I would mention it to people, some people here, and they're like, what's that? You know, what movie is that? I assume that it would have a higher profile somehow, if only because, like, the news kind of aspect of it. But this is a film starring Sydney Sweeney of Euphoria and The White Lotus, directed by Tina Satter, who is adapting her play called Is This a Room? So what did you make of reality?
I was really pleasantly surprised by this. But to speak to your point, I think one of the reasons that it wasn't maybe on so many people's radars here is because, although it's very newsworthy and all those things, it's newsworthy in a very US sense. And I think, like, there's quite a few people here, there's quite a few people on this whole continent who wouldn't know who Reality Winner is, who wouldn't have necessarily followed all of that that coverage. It's also somewhat perplexingly been put into Panorama, which is a strange place for it. Personally, I think I can kind of understand why, maybe if he had, because they have Blackberry, which is another English language North American movie in competition, which is a comedy, maybe they didn't want to have too many films that were kind of similarly covering similar, you know, literal geographical territories in competition. But I think that Reality especially would have been a perfect fit for the Encounters sidebar. So that's, I'm slightly surprised that I didn't get it in there, and I wonder if also that's one of the reasons that people, because Panorama is always such a mixed bag. I mean, it's again like many of the other sections, I think it's particularly strong this year. It's compared to other years in Panorama, it's a really good one, and one of the reasons is because it has a film like Reality in it, which very easily could have been in competition or in Encounters or in any of the other sections. I mean, I was so pleasantly surprised by this, because I mean, I was aware of the Reality Winner story. I can't say it was something that was really, like, you know, felt like grippingly urgent for me to go and investigate this this film. And then I also heard that the conceptual trick of it, which is that the entire film and the play that on which it's based, are that all of the dialogue, like 100% of the dialogue, and not just the words but the ums and the ahs and the coughs and the hesitations, are taken directly from the FBI transcripts of the interrogation of Sydney Sweeney. So this is a film that unfolds almost in kind of real time. It doesn't, not quite in real time, but the actors are all tasked with really, like, literally to the briefest hesitation, recreating this scenario where the evening that Reality Winner came home one day to her house in Augusta, and she, the FBI are there waiting for her, and it's their interrogation of her, which is alternately, you know, incredibly banal, and they talk about random things, and there's lots of non sequiturs. It's the real, you know, it's the non sequitur nature of real speech.
Yeah.
And it's very rare to see that reproduced in this way. And there's something so, I think, so interesting on a sort of metatextual level then as well, because it really makes you, because they are recreating something that is absolutely real. The film is called Reality. Her name was Reality. There's all of these weird ironies. But because of that, it really draws your attention to how not real this is. And it draws your attention to notions of performativity. Sydney Sweeney, I think, is just really outstanding. I'm not a Euphoria watcher, so I haven't really seen her in anything except The White Lotus, in which she's very good, but it didn't seem to be a role that was stretching her very much. So this, in which she's, you know, very de-glammed and just utterly convincing. And then, like, just even on a craft level, the fact that this is being, you know, that Tina Satter, who is the director, also wrote the play, and she has managed to somehow make this film, which almost entirely unfolds within one room, a very dingy room at the back of Reality's house, to make it feel very cinematic, even though it is claustrophobic and there are all these things, but it's a really cleverly shot film as well, really cleverly designed, and you know, brief and to the point. It makes such an interesting comment on the filmmaking process as well as on the process of justice or the lack thereof in the particular case of Reality Winner. So I think, I mean, it's a really and incredibly gripping. It shouldn't, you know, something that is so cold from real life and is so full of those really ordinary offbeat kind of exchanges that just happen as a course of natural conversation, shouldn't really feel like, you know, I don't really know why it has the tension of a mounting thriller, but it really does.
Yeah, it's strange that it's so tense. I mean, it's obviously, on one hand, it's tense because these are FBI agents and she doesn't know where it's going exactly, or is maybe professing to herself that she doesn't know, you know, because I kept thinking, like, I mean, you must have a little idea where this might be going. Although at one point she says she thought it was like a security checkup, you know, or security visit, which, given the way like these government, you know, institutions work, I would believe it. They'll just show up. But it has an incredible tension, and in a way that made me feel the like kind of institutional control. Like I felt you're in their grip.
Yeah, the mechanisms of state power, if they're brought, when they're brought to bear on one individual, it is terrifying.
Yeah,
and you do, even though, I mean, she did do this thing, which was smuggling out one piece of paper and sending it to The Intercept. But again, certainly by the end of the film, there's no question of her guilt or innocence of that particular thing.
Right.
But it's just the incredibly disproportionate sense of all of the of just how angry she has made the system, and that anger is you know, manifesting now in these two guys. And I think also there's, again, back to the sort of the performance aspect of it, because there's obviously Sydney Sweeney's performance, but I think that one of the things that I like so much about her performance is how she performs Reality's performance, because there is there for a long period, I mean, not for a long period, for however many, 20 minutes or something, or 30 minutes at the beginning, she is maintaining her innocence of all of these things, and in such a way that we are cued to kind of believe, we're cued to believe the girl, you know, she's being sort of towered over by these two big guys who are, you know, obviously unwelcome interlopers in her home. There are other FBI agents tramping around her house, taking her stuff and going through her files and everything. And so when she's saying, I don't know what you're talking about, like, you know, this is I know, no, I didn't, and just like, no, I didn't do that, we are weirdly cued to believe her and to believe that she believes that, and to think, suddenly think, oh, is this actually a story of a terrible miscarriage of justice? And then there's just this one moment where I mean, it's not like they're, you know, beating her up or anything, but she seems to make the calculation in her head, and she suddenly then confesses that it actually was her and she did do this. And it is the sort of the seesawing thing of like how the sort of like doubling down, gambling thing of how many times can I double down before I'm actually going to just like lose everything. And so, you know, it's just really interesting to watch those things go on, and they all go on inside Sydney Sweeney's performance. I think it's a really fantastic piece of work, and a first film as well, so, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, not to like paint with a broad brush, but often if you get like a star, buzzy star doing a movie like that about a, you know, topical subject, you know, it's kind of a performance, you know, or it's kind of, I'm just important because I'm in this important news story, but she actually gives a performance.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the whole conversational dynamic, it's interesting, or at least I felt as it sort of morphs between being banal and sort of aleatory, you know, or whatever, into, then I began to think, oh, maybe these are like strategic banalities and strategic, where they let her marinate for a while.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to know, I mean, I actually do want to know, how smart are those FBI guys? Are they, is this like part of their clever pincer movement, or is it all going on in her, you know, and, or are they just so well versed in the mechanics of interrogation that they know if you just create this kind of artificial and very tense and uncomfortable situation for somebody that they will eventually just get there on their own, that they don't actually have to do any like big heavy work really.
Yeah.
But then there was another thing that I was like, I think it was also on me, and I'm sure it was them as well. A lot of what they say at the beginning, and again, there's the gender dynamics of it as well, right? Because there's these two big guys, and she's a relatively small blonde woman. And then, you know, there's a few things that she reveals early on, like she owns lots of guns, and you know, which seems very at odds with her persona as a dog lover and a cat lover and all of these things. And you sort of automatically assume that she's like really, you know, left wing liberal, whatever it is. And then actually, she has all of these other aspects to her, and then, you know, and she's also a translator for the NSA, mm-hmm. so she's fluent in three, you know, Middle Eastern languages. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like, I think the casting of Sweeney was very good in that, because it makes us underestimate her. It makes us underestimate her smarts. So much of them, what goes on afterwards, even that performance of innocent stuff, is so convincing, because I think that, you know, obviously Reality Winner herself is actually a very smart person. Mm-hmm. And so there is a degree to which she is trying to manipulate that situation in her own favor, and then suddenly realizing that she is just outmatched in terms of the sheer power dynamics that are going on.
Yeah, that's really so true about casting her. And also, I guess, there's a kind of metatextual aspect, which there was a brief like mini Twitter like scandal about Sydney Sweeney posting Instagram photos. I can't believe I'm the one talking about this now on this podcast, of her like family, someone's birthday or something. And of course, all her family members are wearing like MAGA hats.
You know? Right. Okay. So, wow.
You know. Uh-huh. And then the kind of other one more layer just to the feeling of her innocence, just from her manner in the beginning. I mean, there are definitely a lot of, you know, people who feel that in a fundamental sense she is innocent, in the sense that she was a whistleblower. So, and that's also something that the movie can let you feel.
Yeah, I think it's, but it is also, it's clever enough to, I mean, and because it is directly culled from these transcripts, of course, so we don't get a huge amount of outside context.
Yes.
She was handed the harshest sentence that has ever been delivered to anybody for an equivalent crime. So, but I think there's one of the things about its sort of quite Spartan presentation is that I don't think it really seeks to change anybody's mind on the ethics of whistleblowing. If you believe in it as a good thing, as I do, you're going to come out of it believing it. But I think that there is a way that you could still, you know, maybe if you were the kind of person who believed that it was actually a traitorous act that she did, and because she was working, you know, for a contractor working for the NSA, that like slightly different rules apply there, and you can't listen to the dictates of your own conscience and all of those things, you could still come out of that film with that view intact, while understanding, I think, a little bit or sympathizing a little bit with her and with that particular situation, and wondering certainly if that is an appropriate way for the state to exercise its power.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, it just seems like the simplest kind of premise and something that could have turned into an exercise in someone else's hands.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You keep on unpacking it, you know, more and more comes out of it. It's I'm pretty excited to see this one like hit the world in a way. Well, one more movie that we can talk about that's like competition title, I guess, is Shadowless Tower.
Yes, competition.
The press screening, maybe unfortunately, was like Saturday semi-early morning.
Yes, 8:45 in the morning, because it's quite a long film.
Which is too bad, because it just, I don't know, charming is the right, it's such a, but it just has this amble to it.
Yeah.
That it sustains kind of incredibly.
Okay, I'm going to try and summon it from the depths of my 17 movies ago imagination. Well, one of the things that comes out, I think, really strongly in it is Beijing, which is, it's very unusual to have a film that deals so fondly with the Chinese capital, not a city that is usually regarded with any particular warmth, certainly in international cinema and in art house cinema, normally a place of kind of alienation and despair. And here, there's a little bit alienation and despair. So it's basically a man going through an incredibly gentle and quite polite midlife crisis. He's a food critic, a restaurant critic of like medium levels of success, I would say. I mean, he seems to be doing okay, but he's certainly not breaking the internet. He embarks on this kind of very elliptical, is it going to happen, is it not going to happen, relationship with his photographer assistant, who is a lovely character who is just the right level of sort of manic pixie dream girl energy, but is also her own person. Yeah. So that's one strand of the film. And then the other strand is he himself is a father. He's separated from the mother of his daughter. Mm-hmm. His daughter, and this is a very Chinese setup, actually, the way families work, certainly when families are broken or schismed in some way. So the mother is, for whatever reason, kind of out of the picture. Yeah. And the daughter lives with his sister and her husband instead. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of scenes of him sort of, you know, going out and getting tipsy and then going home and just wanting to have or going back to their house and waking them up at all hours of the night just to go in and have a quick look at his daughter, you know, who he really loves, and there is a real sense that he is a good dad, but he is not a very present dad.
Right.
So there's that aspect to it, which is then very much heightened because one of the reasons that we get the sense that this is a cycle that's almost perpetuating itself is that his own father was kicked out of the house when he was just 5 years old by his mother for allegedly groping a woman on a bus.
Yes.
And once his mother had found this out, she kicked him out, and he had never seen his father since then. So he himself has had this sort of void in his life, I suppose. But as the film begins, his mother has just died, and his brother-in-law, who's a lovely, affable character, and you can also then really see how oftentimes it's the people who aren't your blood relations who are actually the ones who are most sort of involved in holding together the fabric of those families. So it's his brother-in-law who, for whatever reason, has been contacted by the father, now the brother-in-law gives him his father's phone number and address.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's this ongoing thing. There's the sort of the tentative romance that's happening, and there's also this question of whether or not he should get back in touch with his father. And I mean, I know as I'm describing it now, and even as it was described in the press notes, in the blurb, it sounds like insufferable Chinese mumblecore, and I really was worried that was what it was going to be. But actually, then when you go and when you watch it, it doesn't unfold like that at all. There's something, if anything, it actually reminded me most of Hong Sang-soo, of the kind of rhythms of Hong Sang-soo, because certainly as time goes on, there are these little details that recur, these little motifs that recur in different ways, in very unforced, very natural ways, but they are also slightly supernatural or paranormal or something as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of slippage in time that starts to happen more frequently at the end, where you're not quite sure if this visit to the beach is the same visit as another visit to the beach. Mm-hmm. There's a kite that shows up in various different guises. And if you enjoy the process of picking up on those little clues and matching them together into this lovely little loop-de-loop rhythm, then I think there's just lovely pleasures on offer here.
Yeah.
And it's just a really gentle and wise film. Yeah. And it's got a very wry sense of humor. And again, this sense of place, which I've never really seen applied to Beijing before.
No, I feel like you really capture it. I don't know what I could add. It's one of those movies that kind of reduces me to, like this inarticulate state. Also because it almost feels so fragile what it's doing that once I start describing, I make it less interesting, but yeah, there's that. And I mean, just to explain, since the title sounds almost mythical, it sounds like a tarot card or something, probably. I don't know. But a lot of the action kind of rotates around this one tower, which I might be like a well-known monument, actually.
It is. It's called the White Pagoda, and it's attached to a 12th century Buddhist monastery in Beijing. So it's a very distinctive building on the horizon, and apparently Zhang Lu, the director, deliberately set a lot of the film in the environs of that, in the district where that is, because he knew he wanted this to be to be sort of the central motif of his film. And the thing about that tower is that there's this story that attaches itself to it, that is attached to it, which is that because of the way the tower is designed, and also because of the very built-up area in which it now is, it's very difficult to see the shadow, the tower's shadow.
Yeah.
And you can never really see the complete shadow. And there is this myth that actually its shadow is cast thousands of miles away in Tibet, where its sort of its spiritual home is. So that's why it's called the Shadowless Tower. And there is a certain, you know, there's a poetic resonance there with the idea of this man in middle age, and especially when he's, it feels to me a little bit like he's, people keep on accusing him of being too polite as well, which is a really funny thing to be accused of. But that he's sort of very gently befuddled, and I think it's partly because it's like he's right there, bang, in the middle of his life, and he's not casting a shadow into the past or casting any shadow into the future, and he's just feels suddenly directionless. And I think that's, to me anyway, that's what the tower signifies as well.
Yeah. No, that's really, I actually had thought of the tower in a different way, but one thing I liked about it is that it felt like an open, open metaphor, so it's not like, it ends up being visually prominent, but it's not, they're not beating you over the head with a tower. But I thought of it also just as effacement of origins in a way, that sense that you're without a shadow, or you know, whether it's you're estranged from a parent or something like that, or you're in someone's life but not in someone's life. There's not a shadow to connect you somehow, you know.
Yes. Yeah, you're not rooted to the ground, actually.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
Yeah.
And there is a scene in which he and the photographer character come out of a bar very late at night, and she's like, but where are our shadows? And if you watch that scene, it's funny because it's shot in, you know, quite far away.
Yeah.
And they're talking about, yes, but where, and you're looking at it and she's like, look, the lamppost has a shadow and this wall has a shadow. So where are our shadows? Yeah. And I think that they're not there. I think that they're actually taken out.
Yeah, I think so too.
So there is this strange floaty thing that's going on, but it's also, again, it's done in such a way that it could just be a trick of the light or a trick of them being drunk or, you know.
No, that's a great moment. I was really happy to see this film, and I hope it's also another film that I hope doesn't get lost somehow.
Mm.
So yeah, that's The Shadowless Tower. And there's one movie that I haven't seen, and I have to admit that I kind of had a wait and see approach to it. I thought, I'm going to let some other people take the first fusillade of be the first to receive the light from the projector on this one. And that is Survival of Kindness from Rolf Tahir, which is weird because I think I just recently was talking about Bad Boy Bubby for some reason.
Oh, right. Okay.
And that's the same director, also did, I don't know, Ten Canoes.
Ten Canoes, Charlie's Country.
Charlie's Country. That's the big one. Yeah. In the past few years.
Actually, one of the things, even when we were speaking about A Fire, I think this is another one where it suffers from having, like, just, in this case, a completely inappropriate title. The Survival of Kindness also makes me think that this is going to be, like, I don't know, The Kindness of Strangers or some, like, interlocking story of, you know, people discovering their inner decency or something. And it's completely not that. So I really wish that it wasn't called The Survival of Kindness. However, it is. And yes, it is directed by Rolf Tahir, who is an Australian filmmaker. He's probably best associated, actually, with the Aboriginal actor David Gulpalil, who died in 2022. And I think it's kind of interesting to me because one of the films obviously sort of evoked in the early stages of this is Nicholas Roeg's Walkabout, which was David Gulpalil's breakout film. So there's a kind of a circularity there. The premise of this film is extraordinarily harsh. And I think what's really interesting about it to me is that aside from a slightly overdetermined ending, which I kind of wish he had pulled back a little bit on and left a little bit more to the imagination there. But aside from that, it is a film that is so obvious in its allegory as to be like almost blunt, like just like there's no mistaking what this is allegorizing. Yet it is shot in such a sort of a rigorous and spare and Spartan manner. Not a single word of syllable of intelligible language is spoken by anybody. And it also features the main role in it, an actress called Mwajemi Hussein. It's her first role. Apparently she had never even been in a cinema before she was cast in this film. And she is utterly riveting, especially given that she doesn't have the benefit of dialogue or anything, but you just watch her all the time. So the premise of it is, and where basically the central image, which I believe was the first image that occurred to him, she is in a cage in the desert with nothing to see on all sides, the baking desert, this sort of cracked clay desert in Australia. And she's been padlocked into this cage and left there to die. And so we also know that there's already been a prologue, so we understand that this is either an alternate present or a slightly alternate future. There's a vaguely dystopian sci-fi edge to it as well, because Rav Tahir wrote the script apparently during the pandemic, but also just at the sort of the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. So it's the sort of the conglomeration of those two things, very explicitly actually coming together. And it's a, you know, very much an anti-colonial story and a story of colonial cruelty. So basically the film begins with that very striking image of her left alone in this desert, and it's, you know, she freezes by night and she bakes by day, and then discovers one of the cages of the bars, one of the bars of the cage is slightly loose, and she manages to escape, but she's, you know, just escaped into a vast nothingness. And so then we follow her on this odyssey. She starts to walk, and this is where the walkabout stuff comes in a little bit, and obviously all of those associations that we have with the Aboriginal practice of walkabout. And actually, it's never made explicit that she is actually Aboriginal background. I think the actress herself is from Congo originally. So it's not, there is a certain degree to which he is, you know, not making explicit that this is Australia. He's sort of talking about all colonialism. There's also been a plague has happened, an airborne plague. And so the ruling elite wear these mole man gas masks, these very dehumanizing gas masks, which also serve to muffle their language, which is intelligible to each other, but not to her and not to us. So there's this sort of like very slightly steampunkish sci-fi, dystopian sci-fi element to whenever we see them. As she manages to actually get through the desert, then she sort of, you know, she sees a track which leads to a road which leads into a ghost town, and she gets some clothes, and then she starts interacting with some of the people that she meets along the way, some of whom are dying from this plague, some of whom are, in a recurring motif, are hanged. There's a lot of obviously have fallen victim somehow to this regime of cruelty, and her journey basically then goes to sort of larger and larger places, and ends up in a city, a stone city, which is arranged around a big power plant thing, and it is entirely populated by the people in the masks. And she works out a way that she can use some of the like the clay dust, which is white, and sort of put it over her eyes, and then steal one of the masks so she can almost pass for white. And so all of this is, I mean, it sounds incredibly grim, and it is incredibly grim, but there's such humor and amazement and lightness in her performance, especially some of the ways that she interacts with people. This is the thing, is with an allegory as blunt as this, the danger is that you make all your characters into just archetypes. Like they have no personality because they're representing so much, and that the weight of representation weighs so heavy on them that there's not really any room for an eccentric personality in there. But she's an entirely eccentric personality, and she's really funny at times. She goes into in this ghost town that she finds, first of all, which she's always looking for shoes. This is a big thing, and she's shoes that fit her properly, and there's this sort of odd like abandoned museum, and she starts taking some of the clothes from the mannequins, and just the way she interacts with them, and she salutes one of the mannequins and then steals its hat, and then another mannequin is like dressed as a policeman, and she looks at it narrowly and knocks its hat off and then bonks it on the head with its own truncheon. So it's just like ridiculous things like that, but they really sort of invest her with this sort of sense of humor and a rebellion that makes you really love her. You know, she's a really... And then finally, in the city, she actually encounters two children who are doing the same thing that she is and passing. And there is a bond immediately created between them. They are they look like they're of sort of South Indian provenance. They're also painting their faces white and wearing these masks. And it's sort of her guardianship of them for a little while, but then she also has a greater mission, which I don't want to spoil here, which you can then like reverse engineer into the, being the reason that she was in that cage in the first place, because she's essentially a saboteur. Yeah, so, and then there are many more tragedies that then happen after that. Mm-hmm. And then we have this slightly, there's a kind of a beauty to the way the ending is set up, but then the very closing, I really don't know how to do without giving it away, and I don't want to give it away, but there is a sense at the end where so much of what has gone on does feel like on a slightly astral plane or something. Even though she is a very grounding personality, there's still something odd going on. And if you really look at certain of the things, like where did she get water and how does she, you know, so there's this kind of sense that I think you're supposed to have throughout of like, is this really happening? Is this, and just the very ending sort of tips the film's hand one way or the other, which I don't think it needed to do. So that's the only thing that I really, that holds me back from really holding this up as a truly great film. But I really did enjoy it, and especially for that actress, I think she's amazing. And it's just beautifully shot and peculiar in ways I wasn't expecting it to be.
Mm. Wow. Not what I expected.
Yes.
There were other reasons why I couldn't actually see it, but the synopsis, beginning the way it is, I would not have. Yeah, a lot depended on execution.
Yes, it's true.
So, but I'll try to find a way to see it. Well, that probably brings us to the end. But still more to come, more to talk about. We didn't get to talk about music, which I was hoping to talk about again.
We didn't get to talk about music, and I can talk about music all night. Dance about architecture, talk about music.
I encourage everyone to read Jessica's review in Variety of Music, which is really great. And I didn't even like it as much as she does. So, a pleasure as always, and I wish you a good rest of the festival.
Thanks, you too, Nick.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.